Okay, this presentation is actually best followed on Wiki. If you Google just my last name, Meetian, and the Twitter hashtag, it will lead you to this presentation. I also tweeted the link. You will see a lot of small print here, and if you do so, this doesn't matter, because I'm up for the big picture. And I'm starting with a video, because one of the things I was missing here in the conference so far was interactivity, another one was multimedia, and the third one was use of the internet. So I thought I'll just combine all the three. And what we see here in this video is just a demo of how a taxonomic article could be made interactive. So I'll just play it, and hopefully you will have the sound.
This shows one way that we could redisplay a Zucchi's paper. So we've got the title, the abstract, and we've got the figures that are in the paper, so at a glance we can see what the paper's about. References within the paper are clickable, and if we click on them we see right in situ the actual details of the reference, and we can have more than one of these open if we want to have a look, and we can see there are two papers we might like to go and read. As we go down and have a look, we can see there are some geographic localities. Where are those? We click on them and we can see a Google map. And if we're reading about a particular feature of these frogs, we want to look at the figure, we can just click on the figure, and that opens in place as we read it. Once we've had a look at the figure, as we finished it, we can click on that to close it, but we can keep these as open for as long as we want. So we can have this one open, for example, and down here we can have figure two, and so on. So the idea here is to have a nice, simple display of this article we can interact with. We can look at the figures, look at the maps, and look at the references as we go through and read the paper.
Okay, so this was just a little coding exercise by Rod Page. He did that in one afternoon. So if you deal with those things a bit more intensively, there is a lot of things that can be done once there is some markup text, like there is in Zucchi's papers. I should mention that there's still room for improvement with this thing. For instance, you might have noticed that he clicked on the link to figure 1A and figure 1B, and they both led to the same figure 1, which is a composite figure. And indeed, composite figures are one of the problems if you want to enhance articles, or also if you want to reuse material, which is another topic of my talk. Just to give you a bit of background, the abstract of the talk is here. Basically, researchers produce a lot of different kinds of outputs. Many of these are written, and many of these are written separately. So you submit your paper to the journal, you submit your paper to a conference, and you submit your report to your funders. It's all different documents, and I'm concerned with how you can integrate these different writing processes, and also how you can make those documents living. And in that sense, I'm kind of continuing on the talk from yesterday evening, because living reviews is a concept that I like very much, and it is very similar to Wikipedia, which is why I have that talk on Wikipedia. And it solves some of the problems that you have if you publish just static documents. So the talk will be showing a lot of frogs, simply because this is a nice example. This is a genus of frogs, Pedophrynia, that you may have seen in the news recently, because in December, this guy on the left was the smallest frog in the world, and in January, the guy on the right became even smaller, if you just count the terms when they were published. And this genus of frogs now contains 6 species, all of which have been described in open access journals. And so the figures and all the stuff that is in those papers can be reused, and I'll show you a bit of how they are being reused on Wikipedia. As I said, the best way to follow this talk is actually to follow on the wiki. And you can edit this talk, and this seems to have happened right now, because I actually had several questions here for show of hands. Who of you has ever edited any Wikipedia article? Okay, so it's maybe 1/4 or so. And so I'll put that data point in live. And you see there is actually another question that I had posed. Somehow it wasn't displayed at the first instance, now it is here. Who has not used any Wikipedia this week? It's about the same amount, a little less. Let's say this was 25% and this was something like 20%. I just want to demonstrate that you can edit those documents live. And it's something that is really useful in terms of software engineering. Software developers have used such updatable documents for a long time, and they are collaboratively updatable. So if one coder works on one part of the code, he can push his changes independently from the changes that others have made. And yeah, it all works. And at the bottom of this page, you have here a link to the video I showed on the start. And if you have questions or comments, you can either post them right now when they come to you. I don't mean to give a monologue here. Or you can post them on that page, and we will get back to them after the talk. One of the issues I'm concerned with is integrating scholarly workflows with the web. And as I already mentioned, there are lots of different types of documents that we produce. Some of them are listed on the left, and a representation of the research cycle is on the right. So basically, the thing goes from we have an idea, we develop it, we try to get funding. If we are successful, then we can start planning the experiments, recording data. Once we have the data, we have to process, visualize them. And then there's usually the publishing step. And once things are published, then others, or maybe even we ourselves, read it. And then the cycle starts again. And there are some things happening on the periphery, like teaching, outreach, administration, and also things like database support. That's not directly within the research cycle, but closely related. And the point I would like to make here is that this publishing step, which is one separate step and one single step in the cycle as we do it now, could in principle be decomposed in multiple steps of publishing. So in principle, I could, if I have an idea, I could just post it in a document. And if I develop the idea, I could do this in the same document. If I apply for funding, in principle, I could do this in the same document, and so on. Or I could use documents that are very closely related, and I could do all this online. For instance, on wikis, there are other tools as well. And so the point is that this is technically possible, but socially it has not been desired that much, or nobody has really explored it. And since we're here in a publishing environment, I would just like to bring it to your attention. And I would like to link it to a set of ideas that has been developed wiki style. And there's another video. I hope it fits on the screen somehow. Okay.
Open research. Open research is the concept of scientists sharing their research with the world as soon as they record it for themselves. This is essential to make research more efficient than it is today. Research resembles a puzzle. A heap of pieces has to be assembled into a coherent picture. Yet some of the pieces are unknown, and traditional non-open science keeps much of the remainder hidden behind barriers erected by pre-digital reputation and reward systems. Open science means tackling research problems collaboratively by sharing research tools, data, materials, and code as they arise, and by building on the shared work. As Beethoven said, there should be only one repository of research in the world, to which the artist would donate his works in order to take what he would need. Ideally, scientific research would be in the public domain by default, and Beethoven's repository would be federated rather than centralized.
Okay, so this is obviously just an ideal. Yesterday evening we also had an ideal as a projection of where we might be going as a goal, what we could be aiming at. But yesterday also Mr. Bergelmann asked the question, what are the platforms of the future? And some of them will be discussed in this session, some others have been popping up already. And at the bottom is a link to a project that I'm trying to develop to actually build such a thing, which is very similar to the project that Bernard Schütz presented yesterday. And if somebody else is working on this, I would certainly like to collaborate. Now we go back to the presentation. So there are a number of ideas around of how an article of the future or a journal of the future or publishing of the future might look like. And some people have tried to have a systematic approach to that. So Lambert Heller and also Heinz Pampel, who is here in the audience, they posted a blog post something like 2 years ago in which they enumerated a number of criteria that they see as relevant for the Journal of the Future in Library and Information Science. And I stumbled over that blog post and thought, okay, most of those criteria are applicable to other fields as well. And so we joined forces on a wiki, on Wikiversity, and drafted those criteria, and you can join the endeavor as well. So if you just follow this link here, criteria, you will be coming to the version of the criteria that was the basis for this presentation. And the criteria are all named on the tubs here. So it has something to do with dynamics. So ideally, the Journal of the Future should have more dynamic than the static articles that we have today. The scope should be less limited than it is for the typical journal that we have today. Access should be wider than the typical journal has today. Replicability of the research reported in the journal should be higher than it is today. Review procedures in the journal should be more transparent than they are today. Presentation of the content of the review should be more interactive than it is today. Transparency of any conflicts of interest should be higher than it is today. Sustainability of the journal is of course an issue as well, and it should be at least as well as the sustainability of the journals that exist today. And then we need certain flexibility. So even though we have a set of criteria of this kind, there's always some parameter or some circumstance which may make it impossible to reach all those goals simultaneously, so we need a certain flexibility in approaching them. Let's have a look at the dynamics first. So the research is a process, and the normal paper is just a snapshot. Updating, however, is not so difficult in principle, and the way we do it is very inefficient. It's not just that the documents are static, but most of the paper, of basically any paper, most of the paper is just repetition of what is known already. And then there is a core of new stuff, which can be boiled down, taking the example of the frogs, to just something like this. This is the Wikipedia entry on the smallest organisms, which has a section on vertebrates, which until January 11th said that there is a small fish which is the smallest vertebrate. Then there came out this paper in PLOS One, and it turned out it's slightly smaller than that fish. And so within 1 or 2 hours after the paper came out, the Wikipedia article on that one was updated, and there was already an article started on the species concerned, which is this one. But the main point is actually that the key information from the paper is in this small edit. So this is in principle a way of signaling change or publishing research results. It is not very detailed, but then there were a number of further edits to this article and to related articles So most of the information contained in the paper is already on Wikipedia. Plus, it has been translated. So if you look at that page here, you see there are over 20 different languages that have the article. And if you go on the Thai Wikipedia, for instance, you see it is featured on the home page, actually, yeah. So there is a lot of outreach, which doesn't really work the same way if you have closed content. If this image wouldn't be freely licensed, it couldn't have been uploaded to Wikipedia, it couldn't have been featured on the main page. And then if you look at the number of people that have seen that, it's hundreds of thousands altogether, because it was featured on several different main pages in different languages within a day of the paper being published. That's one way of updating the research record or the secondary record of research. There are other ways. For instance, a number of journals have expressed an interest in collaborating with Wikipedia. And here is a small article about that, published in the newsletter of Wikimedia. And it's interesting that the pioneer in this area is actually not an open access journal. It's RNA Biology, which is closed access. But what they do is require for certain kinds of articles that the authors submit not just their manuscript, but also the draft of a Wikipedia article. That draft goes through the same peer review process as the manuscript. And once the manuscript is accepted and the paper is published, then the Wikipedia article goes live, citing the paper, of course. And so we have a win-win situation. The authors get their paper published. The journal gets a citation from Wikipedia, which always drives traffic. And Wikipedia gets new content. And so this model I find very interesting, but no other publisher has used this model yet. So if you would like to explore it, I would be happy to talk to you. There are other journals that try different approaches, like PLOS Computational Biology is now opening a new manuscript track specifically dedicated to publishing reviews of a certain area and PLOS in computational biology that are written in a way that they can be posted directly onto the English Wikipedia. So they do not just follow the journal guidelines, but also the Wikipedia guidelines for writing articles. And by combining the writing of Wikipedia articles with the writing of journal articles, the authors get credit in the traditional sense, so they get one more publication. And yeah, again, Wikipedia gets new content, and the journal gets a citation from Wikipedia. So that's a circle where no one really loses something. And yeah, there are a number of other journals that also do something like this. For instance, Zookies is exporting the treatments of new species described in the journal automatically to a wiki. It's not a media wiki. It's not a Wikimedia wiki, but it's a wiki, and it's automated. It could be done on Wikipedia in principle, but some policy issues are in between. Okay. Yeah, I already mentioned the topic pages. I'll just show you how it works. And it has a copyright component here. This is another wiki. It's not operated by the Wikimedia Foundation. And that article here is under a CC BY license because PLOS publishes their article under CC BY license. Wikipedia uses a CC BY SA, so share alike, license. So if the article would have been drafted on Wikipedia, it couldn't have been published in PLOS. That's why there is a different wiki set up for this manuscript track. And talking of copyrights and licenses, I was actually surprised to see that none of the presentations so far here had indicated the license under which they are. So mine is on Wikipedia, so it uses CC BY SA. And just one remark, because we had several sessions on which really focused on copyright, but nobody mentioned that. Let's move on with the criteria for the journal of the future. The scope. The thing is, we now have those 25,000 journals which publish 1.5 million articles a year. And yeah, if we continue this way, it's clear that this is just a flood of information. Nobody can make sense of it, even in a small area. And having this living review kind of platform would alleviate much of this, because then instead of having to screen thousands of journals, or at least hundreds or so of journals, for potentially thousands or tens of thousands of articles, you would just have a smaller, very small number of pages to go to, which would then be updated whenever new research results come in. And it can be peer reviewed on the go every time. Also it can be contextualized in a different manner. So to demonstrate this, I just took an abstract of a paper I published in PLOS One and added a few links to Wikipedia articles. And you see, well, it's half blue, half red. So in that area, Wikipedia is not too well established, but still there are a number of things that do not have to be repeated in principle in the paper. But of course, in the paper, we had to repeat them because it was published paper style. So in the introduction, you have a lot of stuff that is already known and could have simply been linked to instead of repeated. And this would make it easier for people to write the paper. It would make it easier for reviewers to review the paper. It would make it cheaper to publish the paper, and so on. In terms of access, probably not too much that I should talk about, but Mr. Bergelmann mentioned yesterday also open access is just the beginning, with which I really agree. One of the aspects that hasn't been in the focus of the open access movement is the reuse aspect. So if you look at this figure, which probably most of you have seen before, it shows the adoption of gold and green access across different disciplines in 2009. So and it was roughly 10% gold and another 10% green. On the order of 20% are already available as open access in some sort, which also means that 80% are not publicly available. And it also means that a large portion of this open access set of articles is under free licenses. So these can be reused. So even if we are still far from reaching the overall goal of having universal access, we can already start working usefully on putting those files or those papers to new users that were not possible before in the purely copyrighted world. And I will provide a number of examples for this. One example is that on Wikimedia Commons, there is now an initiative called Open Access File of the Day. And every day you have one file, maybe an image, maybe sound, maybe a video, or maybe even a whole paper. And then there is a blog commentary on where these files are being used. And most of them are used on hundreds of pages across different Wikimedia projects. And that's certainly something that the authors of the original papers hadn't aimed at. And it's certainly something that has not been planned by anyone. It just happened. And I'm wondering whether we could have a more systematic approach to such reuses. And so I'm, for instance, working on a tool that automatically imports the videos and audio files from open access, freely licensed open access papers onto Wikimedia Commons, so that then they can be reused there. Because in the typical supplementary materials section of a journal, almost nobody looks up those materials. And they are also not featured in a very friendly way. You just typically have a link and a file name. You don't even have a preview as you know it from YouTube or so. Replicability is an issue. And there, the online environment provides a lot of advantages, because you're not limited in space anymore. So in principle, you could add or at least link to any necessary detail or any detail that is necessary to understand the research that you're reporting. I'll not go into detail with all of those criteria. I just wanted to make you aware that there is this list of criteria. And it is editable, and we would like to invite feedback. I'll just go through them shortly. And one of the items that is really dear to my heart is the peer review process. It is one of the major contributions of the publishers to the whole publishing endeavor. and but it's still not very efficient, or to put it in different words, a lot of effort goes into it, but much more of this effort could be coming out or could be reused. So for instance, most of the reviews are good ones, or at least many are good ones, and most of them keep being hidden behind at the journal side. Whereas as a reader, I really appreciate if I can read a review on a topic that I'm really interested in, because it helps me frame my perception of the paper. And many reviews have improved the paper quite considerably, and the reviewers could take credit for that. So I'll just briefly go through those different criteria and then focus on the reuse. The reuse on Wikipedia of those files that we've seen, there are different kinds of reuse. So for instance, we have here a tool that finds citations from Wikipedias, from the top 100 Wikipedias, to DOI prefixes operated by certain publishers. So for instance, if you go to the one by operated by PLOS, you see here there's 2,000, well, almost 3,000 pages on the English Wikipedia that cite a PLOS paper. They might cite several, so that's just a lower estimate. And some of them, some of the citations do not include a DOI, so we are underestimating and at several levels. But what you see here is that there is a fair amount of citations to PLOS papers. And yeah, you can do this if you operate a DOI prefix. You can look it up here. It's not updated very often, but it gives you an idea. Here we have a ranking of publishers by presence on Wikimedia Commons. First, we have an outlier here because proceedings of PNAS, they got 25,000 or 25,301 citations from Wikimedia projects. And this is due to one paper which gets 25,200 or so of these, because that paper contains some structural data for many different molecules, and someone generated all the images for all those molecules and put them out on Wikimedia Commons. So if we put away this outlier, then PNAS has on the order of a few hundred files on Wikimedia Commons. Next one is Pens of Publishers with on the order of 1,200. A small publisher ahead of all the bigger ones. Biomed Central, then the International Union of Crystallography is another such case. They haven't published a lot of papers or that contained images or so that have been uploaded to Wikimedia Commons, but they have published data that others have used to create images of certain molecules or crystals, and so on. You can look where you are in this ranking. I find it interesting that there is another small publisher like Korean Society of Pharmaceutical Science and Technology. They're ahead of Wiley Blackwell, for instance, in this ranking here. Yeah, and there are other tools that give you an idea of how the files are being used on the different Wikipedias. For instance, here this tool shows you that the page DNA on the English Wikipedia has been viewed 390,000 times during November last year, and it contains these and these images from open access sources. So we're moving to file level metrics here. We had the journal level metrics, impact factor, we had the article level metrics, and now here we have something more granular than that, which I think is worth exploring in more detail. And yeah, I already mentioned that the frog, the now currently smallest frog, was featured on different Wikipedias. Here you have the screenshots from all those different Wikipedias, and you can see also the traffic stats. So let's have a look at the traffic stats just for the English one. And these were the days when it was featured. 56,000 people have had a look at this article. If you look at how many people have watched the image, it's roughly the same number. And they also look at related articles. So, for instance, the article on the genus. Yeah, we can do this live here. Article on the genus, 2000 roughly. Time is up, so I'll just move to the summary. And the summary is actually what I have on my laptop. It's this. And, well, it's a story. Open access is just the beginning, as I already said. What we need in order to make it useful is combine it with open licenses. Third, we need to be aware that research is a process, and so that we should get away from static documents. Four, it is important to integrate online and offline activities, so that meetings like these. And five, we need a free and open infrastructure on the web. And now I'm checking whether any of you have posted any questions here. Otherwise, we can do it the classical way. No, nobody. I'm a bit disappointed, but okay. I didn't check Twitter during my talk. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm done.
We have a live meeting here, so we don't have to look at Twitter. I would encourage one or two people from the audience to raise the question here that they just put on Twitter. Richard, here.
Thanks for that. That was very, very interesting. I've got a question about the one of the sets of figures you were showing about citations by ranked by publisher. That I find very surprising. I mean, you know, that would almost beg the question of doing some further analysis. Is there any gaming going on there? It looks very strange that there are some very small publishers with huge numbers of citations way above, you know, even open access publishers where you would expect them to be easily citable because the materials were obviously easily available.
Well, there's gaming there in terms of these publishers making their stuff more readily available, not just in terms of licensing, but also in terms of not just having a PDF version, but also an HTML and XML version, in terms of being visible in the community somehow. I don't know for instance, for this Korean journal, I have no idea why they're that high up. For the others in the top 10, I looked up the reasons, but for that Korean journal, I have no idea. And there are also a number of open access journals that have been around for longer or so, but that do not get cited from Wikipedia for reasons which may simply be that people in this area do not engage that much with editing Wikipedia or something like this. It's a complex matter, and there's certainly a non-homogeneous activity, but I wouldn't call this gaming or biased. And there are those journals like PLOS Computational Biology that are actively engaging with Wikipedia, so you could call this gaming, because it will certainly have an effect on the number of citations they get, but I wouldn't call it gaming, because it's all... These partnerships are official. For instance, Zookies is partnering with Wikispecies, which makes sense because they publish species data. And these things, they are public. And so I don't think that could be called gaming.
Okay, we have time for one more question, somebody? In the back then, and then I'll speak to you.
Hi, some interesting concepts. I'm a bit concerned about a couple of things. If I understood you correctly, the PNAS stats and the cytometer, were they kind of very high because a number of figures were published as additional files, so people were also citing figures? I misunderstood.
That figure was the number of citations from Wikimedia Commons, that is the media repository for Wikipedia, to certain publishers. And on Wikimedia Commons, there are 25,000 files that cite one PNAS paper because they used data from that paper to generate the image that is on Commons.
Okay.
So these files have not been published at PNAS. That would be interesting, 25,000 files in the supplement.
Yeah, I mean, it's You know, how valid are these citations in terms of measuring?
It's someone who did it in their spare time, going through the data in that paper and creating the figures in order to help illustrate Wikipedia articles.
My second point is, if somebody publishes, whether it's a wiki format piece of research that has been peer reviewed, and people and the paper can then be updated, and as you said, the peer review could be done on the fly. Then this model is going to put on a lot more really work for the peer in the peer review process for peer reviewers. So you're actually taxing already busy scientists to do some more work. Every time a paper is updated, before it's updated, has to go through a peer review process.
Yeah,
and if this is done on the fly, it's going to be quite taxing.
Yeah, sure, but. If we want to use such a system for science or for research, we don't necessarily have to follow all the editorial guidelines of Wikipedia. So, for instance, we could have some restrictions on who is allowed to edit, so kind of a curation process, or we could have certain technical tools that just hide the newest revisions until they have been reviewed. That's one aspect. The other aspect is reviewing those small tidbits, like the edit that I showed you, that it's no longer that fish species that is the smallest organism, but now it's the frog species. That is just a few lines of new stuff. That's easy to review even for busy people, and it's certainly easier to review than the normal 10-page paper. Yeah, but in the long run, if many of us would adopt such a system, we would have to review more of those five-line reports of new research and less of those 10-page or more kinds of stuff that we do now.
Okay. Thank you. For the sake of time, I'd like to move on to the next speaker. Thank you very much, Daniel. Jeffrey, over to you.